Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The war in Afghanistan has taken a high-value target. A U.S. drone strike killed the Taliban leader Mullah Mansoor in Pakistan's Balochistan province over the weekend. Mullah Mansoor was believed to be in command of the organization and active number two to Mullah Omar, the Taliban founder, according to U.S. sources. His death, the U.S. says, places the Taliban in serious disarray, a political limbo that even Taliban officials admit will set the organization back for an indefinite period. Sune Engel Rasmussen, reporter for The Guardian, joins us from Kabul. He says this is a risky job to have, at the very least.
Mullah Mansoor had only been the official figurehead of the Taliban since July last year, where Mullah Omar, the founder of the movement, was declared dead. But he had, in practice, he had been running the organization for at least 3 years since Mullah Omar passed away in a hospital in Pakistan. The selection of Mansoor was followed by a very fierce power struggle within the Taliban. And a lot of people not only chose to not follow Mansoor, but some people also took to arms and made armed rebellion against Mansoor. So depending on who will follow him, we can probably expect to see some degree of power struggle again, and that will change the power balance within the Taliban. One of the people who is at least a strong candidate to succeed Mansoor is Sirajuddin Haqqani, the leader of the Haqqani movement, which is used to be a more separate movement, is an older movement than the Taliban, but is also a hardcore wing of the Taliban and a much more irreconcilable wing of the Taliban when it comes to peace talks. Another person that's being mentioned is Mullah Yaqub, who is the son of the late leader Mullah Omar. He's not very old, he's in his 20s, but he has some experience and might be a more unifying figure, because a lot of people will answer to him because he is the son of Mullah Omar. But whichever way it will go, it will change the internal dynamics of the Taliban.
Sune, to get into the sort of conspiracy theory piece of this, is this successful strike possibly a sign that the ISI, the security service of the Pakistan government, gave him up in some sense? They're working closely with the Taliban, it's believed, sometimes, even though they're ostensibly supposed to be adversaries of the Taliban? Or is this an indication, and you've partially answered this question, is it an indication that the U.S. may have some autonomous intelligence operation operating in Afghanistan or Pakistan?
I think the U.S. probably have their own independent intelligence, probably pretty extensive too, in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. It gets a little bit speculative to talk about the ISI's role in this, but like you said, they are a backer of the Taliban, have been from the very beginning. And Pakistan is a fractured system. There's the military, there's the ISI, and then there's the government. They're not always on the same line. People who speculate that the ISI might have given him up, there are some reasons to why they might have done that. And as you say, again, this gets speculative, but one reason they might have done that, if that's the case, is that Mansoor proved to be a pretty difficult partner in the reconciliation process. And Pakistan refused to clamp down harder on the Taliban and kept reassuring both the Afghan government and the Americans that they could lead him or draw him to the negotiating table. That turned out not to be the case. Mansoor didn't at any point show any sign of being interested in negotiating for peace, partly, I think, because the Taliban have momentum right now in the battlefield, so it wouldn't make a lot of sense to them to sit down and talk reconciliation.
Finally, would we anticipate that the Taliban would be quiet for some time as all of this gets realigned and sort of reorganized in the wake of this advance, or would they strike very, very quickly?
Well, there have been some reports from Helmand that commanders have been told to not conduct any attacks at the moment. I haven't had that independently verified, but we haven't seen violence flare up since Saturday. This is the spring season, so I think we can expect the violence to continue. But this is a new situation for the Taliban, and I think right now they have to coordinate some response to this development, to the killing of their leader. But I also think a couple of weeks, maybe a month down the line, I think I would expect at least the Taliban to strike back and retaliate somehow. I don't expect the Taliban to answer to the killing of their leader with reaching out to the Afghan government and all of a sudden turn around and be willing to talk peace. I think, first of all, they need to consolidate the movement and create some unity inside the Taliban. And there's no better way of doing that than to get some military victories in the battlefield. So I think that's probably what we can expect.
He's speaking to us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Sunni Engel Rasmussen is a reporter for The Guardian. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In other violence around the region, more than 120 people have been killed in a 24-hour wave of car and suicide bombs targeting bus stations and hospitals in the Syrian cities of Tartus and Jabla. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the bombings and has warned supporters of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad of more attacks. Those 120 people dead will no doubt be matched by many more who will join the more than 6 million people to flee the country during the civil war. With 2.7 million refugees, Turkey has been a critical sanctuary in the current refugee humanitarian disaster unfolding in the world. Turkey has had much to say about how to deal with the crisis. And in an op-ed in The Guardian today, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said the West has failed in responding to this crisis. And it was not until refugees appeared in the streets of Europe and terrorist organizations such as Islamic State started attacking EU citizens that European leaders realized they could no longer ignore the problem. Turkey is the site of a humanitarian summit that will deal with these issues. What can another summit do? We turn to Shannon Scribner now, humanitarian policy manager for Oxfam America at the summit in Turkey, and Jason Cohn, executive director of Doctors Without Borders USA, which decided to pull out of the summit. Shannon says delegates are overwhelmed with the agenda presented to them, but are determined to make an impact.
The mood is one of cautious optimism, I would say. There are thousands of people here. Its security is everywhere. It takes quite some time to get in and out of the summit. And yesterday, people spent a good part of the day just trying to figure out the map and where they needed to go at certain times for today and tomorrow. We started off with the opening ceremony, and then we went right into some of the roundtables. So we're starting to see and hear some of the commitments on all of these core commitments that the Secretary General has outlined for the summit. So cautious optimism at this point.
Jason Cohn, what about this summit makes it unworthy of your participation, do you say?
Well, for us, we feel that not enough of the agenda is focused on the real core areas of responding to emergencies, particularly in conflict zones. And that's where the bulk of we see the 60 million people who are displaced today, and the most since World War II. And so for us, that hasn't been enough of the focus of the agenda and trying to improve actually how we deliver aid on the ground.
And how is that reflected, do you think? And you can, of course, disagree, Shannon, in Turkey. Is there too much concern about nation states and their status and not so much concern about human beings who are sort of caught between borders and in war zones?
I think some of the criticisms that we've heard are fair in terms of there's no single objective for the summit. The hopes of reform are questionable. And there's a lot of heads of states that just haven't shown up. So Jason's point about the 60 million people that are living as refugees or asylum seekers or have been displaced are on the agenda. You know, they're on the agenda tomorrow as one of the roundtables will focus on upholding the norms that safeguard humanity, and they're also on the agenda in terms of, you know, another roundtable on leaving no one behind. But there are also so many other things on the agenda. So local leadership is on the agenda. Bridging the humanitarian development divide is on the agenda. How are we going to finance all of this? So to maybe Jason's point, things are going to get lost because there are so many issues being discussed.
The historical record of Turkey is not part of this humanitarian summit, but with Turkey's track record in terms of ethnic cleansing and in its dealing with the Kurds and the political situation right now with the migrants coming from Syria, there is certainly an irony there. And I'm wondering if people are feeling that on the ground, Shannon. And finally, is there essentially a recognition that this summit will basically affirm that the 21st century is going to be about recognizing that there are going to be more or less 100 million people who are under no nation state, who are out of the infrastructure of and reach of individual nations, and that it will be up to some sort of humanitarian infrastructure to keep them alive, to sustain their place in the world? Shannon?
I think that is a live topic at the summit, everything that you just outlined. I mean, to Jason's point, you know, the Syrian crisis really didn't come to a head in terms of looking at the over 4 million refugees that are now living in mostly in Turkey and in Lebanon and in Jordan until Syrians started showing up in Europe. And that's when the international community really got seized with this idea of there's too many refugees and displaced people around the world, and we all need this, you know, shared responsibility.
Jason, vital thoughts?
Yeah, I think we can expect countries like Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, Kenya, who have, you know, hosted the brunt of refugees in their country sometimes for decades, to keep safe passage for those people when states like the European Union or, for that matter, here at home, the U.S. government is willing to deport vulnerable people back into Central America, in the case of the U.S., into violence, or send them back from the European Union back into vulnerable situations. So we are real at risk right now of this system that is meant to create safety and security for people who are the most vulnerable, really crumbling. And we've seen that with Kenya saying it's going to close the Dadaab refugee camp, where for 25 years Somalis have found some sanctuary from the conflict in their country. We see it in the EU-Turkey deal. We see it played out very quietly here at home in terms of children being deported back to Central America, where they've faced forced recruitment by violent gangs in places like Honduras and El Salvador. So the system in itself for safety is really, I think, at a breaking point. But it's a political choice. It's not a question of resources in my mind. It's governments taking decisions and not upholding those very norms that are supposed to be debated tomorrow.
Jason Cohn is Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you very much, John.
And speaking to us from Turkey is Shannon Scribner, who's Humanitarian Policy Manager, Oxfam America. Shannon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A military parade at the Presidential Palace in Hanoi, welcoming President Obama ahead of a joint news conference with the country's president, Tran Dai Quang. The complicated relationship between the U.S. and Vietnam may have gotten just a little bit simpler.
This change will ensure that Vietnam has access to the equipment it needs to defend itself and removes a lingering vestige of the Cold War.
President Obama in Hanoi announcing the end of a decades-long arms embargo on Vietnam, moving it from former enemy to potential arms customer of the U.S. President Obama is now the third sitting president to visit this Cold War adversary since President Bill Clinton visited in 2000. With me now to discuss this ever more normalizing relationship is Edward Miller, the author of Misalliance, No Din Diem, the U.S. and the Fate of South Vietnam, and a professor of history at Dartmouth College. He says visiting Vietnam seems to have become a 21st century tradition for U.S. presidents.
The U.S. normalized its ties with Vietnam 20 years ago in 1995. And since then, the relationship has really grown by leaps and bounds. And when you go to Vietnam today, when you talk to officials in both governments, they really make it clear that this is a warm relationship and it's a high priority for both of them. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the reasons has to do with the shared concerns about China, especially China's aggressive moves in the South China Sea in recent years. I think there's also, though, a lot of focus on trade. Trade is booming between the United States and Vietnam. It hit more than $30 billion last year. And then I think there's also the issue of the memory of the war and reconciliation between the United States and Vietnam.
In the region, you've got Taiwan, China, interesting challenges in the South China Sea that seem to be confronting the Philippines. Where does Vietnam fit into all that, or is it in some ways insulated from all that, and that the U.S. goes to visit Vietnam to get away from those confrontations?
Vietnam is not at all insulated from the conflicts in the South China Sea. Vietnam is actually one of the major players or contestants that's involved in the ongoing disputes over the South China Sea. Like China, Vietnam claims sovereignty over a huge portion of the South China Sea. And of all the various claimants, Vietnam and China are the ones that are in most direct conflict and direct confrontation. Vietnam claims sovereignty over both of the major island chains in the South China Sea, the Paracels and the Spratlys, as China does. The other countries in the region claim pieces of those chains, but Vietnam, along with China, is really one of the central actors.
Wouldn't it be ironic if the U.S. were to actually get access to the extraordinary port at Cam Ranh Bay as a base to watch, I suppose, contain, the Chinese would say, the People's Republic of China after the war when that bay was used for naval operations against the Vietnamese themselves?
I think that would be ironic from a historical standpoint, but at the same time, it would also fit with sort of larger patterns in Vietnamese history, because Cam Ranh Bay has long been a very strategic port. It's the best natural deep water harbor in Southeast Asia. And so many different countries over the last century have used it as a naval base. France, Japan, the Soviet Union, and of course the United States during the Vietnam War. So if the United States does gain access to Cam Ranh Bay, it will be regaining access, and it will be sort of continuing this pattern of great powers who have used it as a staging point.
What do you make of this embargo, you know, dropping this embargo that the President Obama did today? Is it a significant move forward or just a symbolic gesture? And does the U.S. have influence on human rights issues in Vietnam?
Well, let me take the issue of the arms embargo first. It's more than just a symbolic gesture. I think on the one hand, it is something that the Vietnamese government has been seeking for a long time. And so in that sense, it's something that Obama can offer that the Vietnamese government really wants. From the United States standpoint, I think this is clearly being undertaken with an eye on China and with the escalating tensions in the South China Sea. However, I do think that this could have a potential impact going forward. Vietnam still buys the majority of its military hardware from Russia, and that's a direct legacy of the Cold War when Vietnam was in the orbit of the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 1980s. Potentially, this could change it. This could lead over the long run to closer U.S.-Vietnam military relations. And potentially, it could lead to more revenue for American defense contractors. So in all those ways, it's significant. On the question of human rights, the United States certainly has influence with this. And I think that U.S. diplomats, the U.S. mission in Vietnam, spends a lot of time talking to their Vietnamese counterparts about human rights. And actually not just talking. U.S. diplomats in Vietnam routinely make a point of visiting opposition figures who have been targeted by the regime for their views on democracy and on other human rights questions. So this is an important aspect of U.S.-Vietnam relations. It's clearly not the most important aspect. I think the economic and the security considerations take precedence over human rights, but it's definitely a key part of the relationship.
Edward Miller is professor of history at Dartmouth College, author of Miss Alliance, No Dinh Diem, the U.S. and the Fate of South Vietnam. He's also the founder of the Dartmouth Vietnam Project. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and today we have a verdict for a city on edge. It's not guilty. In Baltimore, the first verdict for one of the six officers accused in the Freddie Gray case has been reached. Baltimore police officer Edward Nero was found not guilty on all four misdemeanor charges he faced. The decision comes a little more than a year after Gray's death in police custody in April of 2015, which was followed by violent protests and a tougher national discussion about police officers' use of force. Joining me now is Kenneth Burns, Metro reporter for WYPR in Baltimore. Welcome to The Takeaway, Kenneth.
Thank you, John.
So what is the situation right now? The mayor has already said for people to be patient. What are the specific details that in this verdict are likely to inflame or possibly keep people from becoming more, I guess, filled with the inclination to repeat the unrest of last year?
Quite honestly, John, it's the fact that Nero was found not guilty. We're talking about the situation itself took place in a community that already feels that they are not treated fairly by police. So here comes this trial with Officer Nero and the verdict announced in court of not guilty on all charges. And just by quick recap, assault, reckless endangerment, and misconduct. And the judge in his verdict said that the state did not meet the burden of proof that will go beyond reasonable doubt.
Now, are any of the other defendants likely to have a different outcome here in the sense that they're charged with different crimes or the facts are different for them?
It's going to be different because the facts will be different for them. And then on top of that, not all of these trials will be bench trials like the Nero trial was. Some of them might go to the jury. The next one involves the van driver, Officer Cesar Goodson, which is scheduled to begin next month on June the 6th. And his set of facts are different. One thing you'll notice from the verdict is that Judge Barry Williams, who himself is African-American, dissected this part of the timeline from when Freddie Gray was pursued by officers at one part of the neighborhood up into the second stop where they shackled him and put him back in the police van.
And it would seem that the judge's verdict here, the judge's decision, suggests that without any very nefarious intent, essentially, Officer Nero needed to have decided when he was eating his breakfast that he was going to commit some act of reckless endangerment. Without that intent, there's not a guilty verdict here.
Exactly right. The judge said that for the state to prove their charge, they would have to prove that Nero had malice to hurt somebody, or in this case, hurt Freddie Gray. He said the state did not offer that proof. He also said that they didn't offer any proof that Nero knew about this policy that the state was hanging their hat on, and that Officer Nero was required to seatbelt Freddie Gray. And he also pointed out that it's up to the van driver to seatbelt Freddie Gray, or the policy that was updated had more to address towards the transport drivers than it did street officers.
So the initial verdict here, spoken of broadly, is an unfortunate accident in the case of Freddie Gray. We'll see what the community feels about that. But it's the first verdict Officer Edward Nero found not guilty on all four misdemeanor charges he faced. We've been talking with Kenneth Burns, who's a Metro reporter for WYPR in Baltimore. I'm sure we'll have more questions for you later on in the week. Kenneth Burns, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
On the road to the Stanley Cup, the good news is that the San Jose Sharks have a Game 6 this week on Wednesday at home against the St. Louis Blues. The bad news is that Game 5 is tonight in St. Louis, two time zones away from home. These have been some migrating Sharks that have had to play many, many playoff and regular season games with their eternal clocks disrupted by jet lag. Teams looking for an edge of any kind in these infinite playoffs. A few years ago, the San Jose Sharks looked to sleeping habits as a possible hindrance to performance on the ice. Sherry Ma is a sleep research fellow at the Human Performance Center at University of California, San Francisco. Sherry has consulted with the Sharks and the NBA's Golden State Warriors. Also with us is Mike Potenza, the strength and conditioning coach for the San Jose Sharks. Sherry and Mike, you're both awake now, right?
we're
both here.
Welcome to The Takeaway. So how does sleep performance have an impact on hockey players who seem like some of the most awake people in the universe, Sherry?
Sure. So we know that sleep is foundational and an essential component of sports performance. And unfortunately, oftentimes it's significantly overlooked and underappreciated. But we are starting to recognize that this particular aspect of their training can have an important component on overall health, wellness, and performance.
Mike Potenza, what is the typical response when you tell one of these NHL players, get your rest now?
I would say years ago they would have kind of shrugged it off and wouldn't have the respect for, you know, something as minuscule as sleep, you know, and to helping their performance. But now the culture of training in hockey has changed so much that guys are looking for an edge and they'll take whatever they get, and they feel the effects because we go into every time zone on road trips. We're going back and forth two different time zones, as we did against Nashville as well.
Do you think the Sharks being on the West Coast have a particular disadvantage, sort of like the East Coast teams where you're playing a lot of games across these time zones?
It may sound crazy, but I think we have an advantage because throughout the whole year and over the last few years, we're one of the most traveled teams in the National Hockey League. So we travel the most out of any team being in the Pacific and having to go, you know, on a road trip through maybe two, maybe three time zones at a time. The furthest team west for the East Coast teams is Detroit now. So they really don't have to travel across. When they're crossover games, yes, they do, but not as frequently as us.
Man, those East Coast folks, you know, they always get the advantage. So when you know that your players are going to be ragged from some of this travel and time zone disruption, where does it affect the game, do you see?
I think in our starts, you'll see a sluggish group at the start of a game, and then they pretty much can pick it up towards the third period. They'll get a little more acclimated. We don't see it as much in the morning at pregame skate, but once that game starts, their body clocks are on a different time, a time when maybe they're coming off a nap or maybe they're a little bit down-regulated in their normal time zone. And that particularly has to be about the game time in, you know, the new time zone they're in. But also, you know, with multiple games, they'll see some energy in the players start to trickle away or start to go down at the end of a road trip or something like that.
So, Sherry Ma, in terms of clinical research and medicine, what can you do about this and how do you measure it?
Sure. So some of our studies have particularly looked at the impact of circadian disruption or when teams are crossing over multiple time zones. And it is an important factor to consider for teams that are traveling over, like I said, multiple time zones, because it has been demonstrated to be an important factor on game outcomes, particularly, say, East Coast versus West Coast matchups. And so obviously, through the last couple of years, Mike and I have had discussions around ways in which we can try to look at implementing strategies to minimize the impact of jet lag and hopefully maximize performance.
So, Sherry, is this a new thing in all professional sports trying to deal with this? And it's really a big issue for the NHL and the NBA because their playoffs are not in a neutral venue.
So I think over the last couple of years, there's definitely growing interest in sleep from teams across all the leagues. It's not something that's new. Obviously, teams have had to travel and consider sleep and recovery for years. But I think that there is more peaking interest in this area because many teams recognize they often haven't looked at this as deeply as, say, other components of their training regimens from nutrition or the physical training side.
So what nutritional suggestions or maybe, you know, spa music with the Stanley Cup videos kind of slowly moving on the screen that will put the hockey players to sleep who need to get to sleep?
No, great question. So oftentimes a lot of athletes really haven't gone beyond getting, you know, quote unquote, a good night's rest before a game or an important competition. And there's much more to it. We want to look at optimizing both their sleep duration and their sleep quality. And assessing and monitoring that over a whole season is really what the goal is, rather than looking at trying to optimize their sleep, say, when it heads to playoffs or right before that important game at the end of the season.
Mike Potenza, it is the case that you have the best logo in the universe, correct?
I agree.
I mean, but that isn't going to overcome the conditioning issues and the sleep issues. So what's your assessment for game 5 and game 6?
You know, we've been good on the road all year. We haven't been the best team at home, which is very Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde-ish, if you will. But I think through this playoffs, you know, we still have kept up our paces on the road. I think you're going to see, you know, no pun intended, a hungry team, and you're going to see a team that's going to come out with their legs. I like our chances, and I always have liked our group. We're a solid group, a good mix of people, you know, veterans and young players. So,
well, there's a super fan named Isabel on our staff who is rooting for the Sharks. So why don't you just tell them in the locker room to do one for Isabel?
I will, and I know she's from Richmond, so we're gonna do it for Richmond. So.
All right, Sherry Ma and Mike Potenza, thanks so much.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
Sherry Ma, Clinical and Translational Research Fellow at the University of California, San Francisco Human Performance Center, and Mike Potenza, Strength and Conditioning Coach for the San Jose Sharks in the Stanley Cup playoffs. We asked you, how many hours of sleep do you get a night? And when you don't get enough sleep, how does it affect you? South Carolina, about 6 to 7, probably not enough. I just stay up too late reading online and then wake up when my husband wakes up, but he falls asleep a good hour or two before me. I think I'm probably about 5% off my game on a regular basis because I don't get enough sleep.
My name is Mia from Oakland, and when I don't get enough sleep, it doesn't affect me at all. It just makes everybody else intolerable.
877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Tweet us at The Takeaway. It's in the rhetoric of the 2016 campaign. It's in the tragedy of the European migrant crisis. The borders of the modern nation state are being everywhere tested. Nationhood, which came into being at the end of the Napoleonic era in the 1800s and grew to become the essential symbol of political order at the end of the 20th century. Nations and flags added up to human civilization at the dawn of the 21st century, but it didn't add up. You can hear the defensiveness of the nation state in Donald Trump's plans to build walls. You can hear the fear of the nation state in the political rhetoric of right-wing nationalists in Austria, Germany, and France. But perhaps the most successful challenge to the nation state is the quietest and the oldest. Nick McDonald spent years with nomadic groups around the world and studies their histories and political practice. He's the author of the new book, The Civilization of Perpetual Movement, Nomads in the Modern World. Nick says nomads are finally demanding that their way of life be recognized politically by the imperfect nation states that have tried to pen them in for centuries.
Nomadism has been a challenge to the nation state since there have been nation states. In fact, if you look at the historical record, you will see in some parts of the world that though there were hunter-gatherers to begin with, there was agriculture after that, and then after that, there was larger scale nomadism, because oftentimes nomads were folks who did not want to have to farm and be taxed and conscripted the way that whoever was running the valley wanted them to be. For a great number of people, it is a form of life, a political expression that is as vibrant and as important as any other.
At a moment when the United Nations, given the refugee crisis in Syria and in Europe, is trying to figure out ways of giving people an identity that's independent from national state passports, what do you think nomadism says about identity and being in a nation state in the 21st century?
I think if you look at nomadism over the grand durée, what it says is that it doesn't have to be this way. And that's the thing that it always was for me. When I was in graduate school, I read a textbook that they assigned to us. And it said, nomads have played no major role in world history for 500 years. And I thought, that doesn't square with what I've seen as a reporter. And as I looked into the various nomads around the world, I realized these borders don't have to be this way. And if you look at the migration crisis now, who is from where and why they should be from where is something that as a whole world we're reexamining. And the practice of nomadism has been about that from day one.
And in fact, a lot of the problems in the world relate to obstacles in the way of nomadic tendencies. I mean, I think Saudi Arabia, for instance, there's no reason why the House of Saud would settle down except for the fact that they had all the oil.
Saudi Arabia is a place I never did any research. But, you know, the decision to settle to accrue wealth is not totally exclusive from nomadism. I mean, there were plenty of rich nomads. But certainly it led us down a particular path. I mean, agriculture is one way to go. Nomadism is another. In this country, for example, we wrote all kinds of laws about why agriculture is the basis of our republic. And if you own land, then you get to vote. Historically, people are always trying to sedentarize nomads. Governments, as a rule, don't like it when you move around, because when you move around, it's hard to count you, it's hard to tax you, it's hard to conscript you into the army. And so in nearly every government in the history of the world, they have seen groups of nomadic people and they have said, you must stop moving. And the argument that I make in this book is that often that's not the best thing for the government. And certainly it's not best for the environmental, you know, future of certain parts of the world.
Among the nomads you've studied and done research on, who's having the best time?
Ooh. Oh, boy. In the Gobi Desert, I had the great pleasure of spending a little time with a whole bunch of nomadic families. And one old lady explained to me, Her name was Jamyan Saran. And Jamyan Saran was telling me about her grandchildren and how they would come and hang with her sometimes, but other times the next generation spent most of its time in Ulaanbaatar. And she said, you know, being a nomad is the best thing in the world. It's the best way to live when the weather is good. But I think that it's not going to be this way for my children and my children's children. I hope it is. But a lot of them want to live in the city. But it is the best way to live when the weather's good. No one wants to stand in the snow looking for sheep when it's windy, etc. But those afternoons with her and that family out there, you can see, without romanticizing it, because it's not rich, it's not, you know, it's not always great, literacy is not great. These are people who are smart, satisfied, and know what else is out there.
Any attraction for you?
It's hard to imagine growing up in New York City that you would want to spend more than a month moving across the tundra with reindeer. And yet, you get up there, and when it's not so cold, suddenly it seems like this isn't such a bad way to live. And that's the thing about nomadism. I mean, it looks as far away from New York City as you can get. But once you start doing it, it doesn't actually seem to be so different than some of the things you've seen before.
How much variation is the ways in which family rules and family needs sorted out in a nomadic context?
The Kuchi of Afghanistan have a very rough deal. They are often poor, they are often illiterate, and they move through byways that are often at war with between the Taliban and the United States, different groups out there on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. But the women in the Kuchi families often are treated and assume a much more serious position than the men. And I think this is a true thing of nomadism, that the family unit and the small unit of organization tends to be more egalitarian.
Finally, can you describe the most arresting visual contrast between a nomad who's practicing behaviors and traditions that are hundreds, perhaps thousands of years old, and some technology that is, you know, of the moment?
Mm. Well, there are many of those, and they are fantastic. The one that stayed with me, and I unfortunately did not see this myself, but it was reported to me and there were pictures of it. There is a gentleman named Mukhbayar Setsergi, depending on your point of view, an eco-terrorist or a radical or a revolutionary. He's a Mongolian fellow, and he believes that Mongolia, a country where 30% of the population still fully is nomadic at least part of the year, should stay that way. And there's a great deal of copper in Mongolia, and the economy is changing very rapidly. Some people say it'll be like the Brunei of Central Asia. But Mukhbayar doesn't want it to go that way. He thinks that people should remain nomadic. And to make his point, Mukhbayar and his attorney rode on horseback past the statue of Lenin, past the Louis Vuitton shop, and into Sukhbatar Square in the center of Ulaanbaatar, where Mukhbayar then fired his bow and arrow into the windows of the Mongolian parliament before being taken to prison. And this, I thought, was an extremely shrewd piece of political theater, which he was aware of and stayed certainly with the Mongolian population and with me.
And pictures of it which are likely shared on nomadic-owned iPhones all around the world.
That's very true, yeah.
Nick, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Nick McDonald is the author of The Civilization of Perpetual Movement, Nomads in the Modern World. A little something to take with you today. He was a nomad for about 24 hours, wandering 10 miles in the wilderness of Alaska. An 80-year-old Fairbanks man lost his boat and spent the night in the Bonanza Creek area. William Page is his name, and he called Alaska State Troopers on his trusty cell phone. Nomads use them, you know. At 7:46 a.m., a patrol car failed to find him, but a chopper eventually located him. Tough Alaskans. Don't you think so? Well, get plenty of sleep, won't you? We will be with you tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.